Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. This is the fourth and final part of our gift from Matt Wallace, The End of Flesh. If you are new to our podcast, please go back and listen to parts 1, 2, and 3. This episode is not work safe or kid safe. It has some very disturbing scenes in it. Before we get into our story, I want to share something with you. I don't normally talk about personal things on this podcast. An author and podcaster that we know is suffering through a tragedy this Christmas. I'm not going to share his name here, because I respect his privacy. He lost his brother to a tragic accident. The only reason that I bring this up is because it brought back very difficult memories for me. In August of 2006, things were going well for us. The podcast was going strong. And we had been nominated for our first Parsec Award. Then tragedy hit my family. My sister was struck by a car while standing next to her car. A few days later, she died. My point to bringing this up is simple. During this holiday season, please cherish the moments that you have with your loved ones. Every second with them is important, because those moments are part of you and will be with you forever. Now, on to our story. The End of Flesh, Part 4, by Matt Wallace. A trail of shed blood and sacrificed flesh, a pound of it his own, has led Detective John Busboy Paxson to the doorstep of a newer and even more terrifying secret kept by the Carrion Underground of the future. And the final answer lies under the Dutchman.
The End of Flesh by Matt Wallace. Part 4, Under the Dutchman. It all started to make a weird kind of sense. The Holland connection. They'd already legalized carrion feeding over there, and everybody knew if you wanted to try eating another human being without having to hide it, the world's most famous red light district was the place to be. So Rosalie's backpacking through Europe. She meets a charming young Sucha. They become best pals. The Secha introduces Rosalie to Old Man Visser. Before you know it, she's part of the family. They get her good and indoctrinated. Rosalie, the city councilman's daughter. Pax can just see her, turning on the doe-eyed little girl act. Daddy, approve the zoning for my best friend's father's new restaurant, please. Make sure no one asks any questions about what's underneath the place. Keep the cops away, keep the inspectors away. And he does it. Whether he's in on it or not, whether they both are, he does it. Pax parked his slide peg of a car around the corner from Visser's. Sitting in the front seat, he checked the extra clip for his HK, felt for the pair of speed loaders tucked in his belt, graphite rings with settings of .357 bullets. Climbing out, Pax walked around to the bumper and pulled up the back door. Wedged between the boxes inside, his Ithaca was wrapped in its soft linen cloth. Pax stashed it under his coat. He grabbed a handful of extra shells from an ammo box next to the emergency gas can, digging deep the way a kid does with candy from a dish on Halloween, and stuffed them in his coat pocket. Past the corner, a beam splitter was still laser sketching the blue and white guy assembled behind the burning red Visser's sign. The doors were closed. The valets had all knocked off. The street was almost empty. Remember the victim. Don't let them become food. Pax tried to remember the Barillo kid, his smile, his resume. What the ghouls he was there to take down turned all that into. But mostly his head was full of Rosalie. Pax was walking a straight road now, no forks, no turns. Simple. the way any detective liked it. It summed up like 2 + 2 in his head. If they were burning a trail, she was in there. If she had a place at the table, she was in there. Either way, Pax knew where he was going. Though the restaurant was closed, there'd still be a mess of people inside, cleaning up, counting money, tallying receipts. Pax ducked around back. He spotted a group of Mexicans rolling bones against the wall of the alley. Busboys. He was right at home. He listened to the excited Spanish chatter, watched the money change hands. Then he noticed something. It started with one of the busboys who stood off to the side, who didn't seem interested in the game. Then Pax began checking shoes. He spied the secondhand loafers, the garage sale tennies worn by poor labor. And there stood out one busboy in stained apron and cheap work pants wearing a pair of $200 cross trainers. Imported, no less. That was his man. Pax came up on them slow, then a couple of yards away he peeled back his coat and racked the Ithaca for all its slide was worth. The busboys looked up, then they scattered. Whether Pax was a rippin' runner, La Migra, or just a crazy white man with a gun, they knew better than to stick around and find out. In seconds, they cleared the alley. All except one. No surprise, it was a pair of fancy cross trainers left soaking in the alley puddles. "Police!" Pax yelled. "On the wall! Fill up those bricks, now!" The busboy did it. Pax moved in on him, and when he'd closed the gap to about 2 feet, the busboy's right hand went for the inside of his apron. Pax rammed the Ithaca's short stock into his left kidney. The shock it sent through the busboy's system was an override that canceled out everything else, including standing. He slumped to his knees. Pax patted him down, feeling under the soiled linen until he pulled something from a fancy concealed sheath. It wasn't a gun. Pax stared at the wicked-looking flaming blade of a titanium bowie. You could gut a boar in 2 strokes and turn his integral organs into abstract art at the same time with that kind of knife. Pax stabbed an inch of the blade into the brick wall and then grabbed the busboy by his anointed hair. It smelled like baby oil and felt like spaghetti out of a can. He shoved the busboy back against the wall beneath the bowie. "I'm here for the Dutchman," Pax said. "You understand? I know you're a plant, I know you're a sentry, so don't waste my time. I need to get below. I need a back door, an escape route I can backtrack, anything." The busboy didn't give it up. More than that, he didn't make a sound. Pax barrel whipped him at the base of the neck. All he got for his trouble was the rasp of sucking wind. It surprised Pax. People usually talked when he did that. Somebody had conditioned this kid well. Pax spun the busboy around, got another handful of the soggy vermicelli on top of his head. He stuck the Ithaca's boar under the busboy's chin until he was sure the kid could feel it against the bottom of his tongue. "The back door," Pax repeated. "You know I'm gonna find it, right?" Then he tossed his gaze back into the alley, added a baker's hint of a grin, like maybe he already knew something he shouldn't. It worked. The busboy's eyes ticked just for a second in the direction of a mess of trash cans gathered around the wall a few yards down. Pax snipped a zip tie from the dispenser on his belt and cinched the busboy's wrist around a length of pipe. Then he gave him a goodnight kiss with the butt of the Ithaca. He walked down the alley, started kicking over cans and yanking up boxes of spent packing foam and rotten vegetables. There were 2 big steel cellar doors and a space for a padlock, but no padlock. Instead, someone had installed a shiny new key lock. A minute with his pick and Pax heard the magic snap of a bolt. Still, he practically had to crowbar the doors with his Ithaca to get them open. When he did, there was nothing but dark downward waiting for him. Pax didn't find a dungeon, just a storage cellar. Rough cinder block walls, crates, and barrels. Must and dank and something squeaking territorially from a corner. Pax rifled the place, knocked everything over, pulled down everything against the wall. Nothing jumped out at him. He unfolded his tactical blade, started chipping randomly at the mortar and the walls. One wall, then another, then halfway across the third he skinned a wad from between the blocks. The mortar was soft. It swallowed all 3 inches of the blade. Here the mortar was paste, purely cosmetic. There was nothing to hold the blocks in place. Pax leaned the Ithaca against a crate of fertilizer and cracked out his shallow and spade. He used the bell-shaped end to pry the loose blocks from the rest of the wall. When he was done, he'd carved a 3-foot square hole to reveal the crawl space that stretched behind it. Pax grabbed his Ithaca and went down the rabbit hole. It was definitely an escape hatch. Inside, Pax found a flat trowel for pushing the loose blocks into the basement he'd just left. At the other end of the crawl space was a door. He listened at it for almost a minute, but heard nothing. He opened it, probed with the barrel of the Ithaca. There was a 4-foot drop and no sign of lurkers. Pax leapt down. He stood in the middle of a corridor, surrounded by first-class masonry work. The walls of the sub-basement were smooth granite, almost like bone, hand-carved with dioramic murals. There were rugs on the floor, rich, red, and gold trim, so soft that Pax couldn't hear anything, not even his own footsteps. That was good, but also unsettling. Past rooms, chambers that smelled like blood and sex and rot, rooms that stank of uncooked meat, a scent that should have been sickly, but which Pax found a little heady. The biggest room he came across had a clear pool in the center, large enough to accommodate several dozen people, and walls lined with showerheads. The floor was self-cleaning, a million tiny pores that irrigated and suctioned. Pax found only a few specks of residue, but it was blood, no question. It was starting to grate on Pax, this extraordinarily constructed, meticulously kept underground Shangri-La with nobody in it, when his peripheral vision caught a flash of red on the move to the right. Pax pressed himself to the stone, flat as a board, watching as the flash of red became a whole man in red and rounded a corner. Pax pursued. The guy wore a red robe with subtle gold ruins, hood pulled down like a monk. There were circles with black velvet crosses on the huge sleeves, archaic script inside the crosses that Pax had no way to decipher. Pax only recognized him as man because of his hands. He shadowed Little Red Riding Hood down the corridor, watched as the man ducked through a narrow cutout of a doorway. If that room was empty as the rest, then Pax had his chance, a chance to get some directions at least, and maybe even a few answers. Creeping up on the doorway, Pax stopped. He was getting that behind-the-eight-ball feeling, the sense of being duped, or about to turn a wrong corner. No sound came from inside the room, none at all. He didn't feel like a man sneaking up on somebody, he felt like somebody being snuck up on. He had already started to backpedal when a red blur suddenly filled the doorway, and there was Little Red Riding Hood cradling a submachine gun. Pax didn't have the angle for a quick kill and couldn't acquire one before a 2-second burst of lead would cut him in half. He turned and dove around the bend in the corridor as his new friend opened fire. Bullets chipped away the smooth line of the corner, giving it a hockey player's smile and raising a chalk cloud that dusted Pax's jacket. He coughed. Then came a dry click. It echoed between the stone walls of the corridor. An empty magazine or a jam. Pax didn't waste time thinking on which. He broke cover and fired, getting a piece of the wall and a piece of the monk's shoulder. Little Red Riding Hood stumbled. The next blast from the Ithaca gutted him. Pax really had to move now. The gunfire would bring more sentries, more red-robed hell priests packing machine guns, and would alert everything else, whoever or whatever they might be. He swept through the corridors, trying to check every room and cover every danger zone without breaking stride. He knew he was lost in a maze that felt more and more like a tomb with every passing second. Ahead of Pax, the corridor ended in an arch that reached from floor to ceiling. Set inside it on hinges as big as mortar shells, a set of industrial steel doors were left open, swept against the stone walls. Pax approached them slowly, half-crouched, holding the Ithaca in front of him like some kind of magic scepter that would ward off the evil within. He came up to the threshold, felt the soft brandywine light from inside on his face. Pax dipped the Ithaca's barrel into it and stared over the bore. The expansive chamber stretched out in every direction from the doors, and the ceiling rose to a vertigo-inspiring height that meant they were deeper down than Pax thought. He guessed the corridors must have gradually sloped the whole way. The walls of the chamber, huge three-dimensional mosaics hanging from them, were lined with people standing on rises, robed the same as the monk Pax had splattered the corridor with. He saw no faces, just vague black slits where the hoods drooped down around their heads. Tuxedoed attendants, tiny people, dwarves wearing leather hoods with padlocked mouth slits, were stationed far apart in front of the rises. Their tuxedos were as strange as the hoods, as if hardcore sadomasochists had run England during the Victoria era. In their hands they held big oval platters that trapped the light and made it dance. The platters were empty. For now. Pax's eyes, and by proxy his gun sights, were drawn to the center of the room. A collection of boulders stood alone. They weren't actual boulders, Pax realized, but white marble carved into that shape, with throne-like seats and steps worked into them. Three people occupied the boulders, arranged like the hierarchy of a lion pride. Two of these figures wore the same hooded robes as the rest, but the third, seated highest above all, wore white robes, and instead of a hood, a helm covered his head. shaped like some kind of goat or ram, and had horns and a set of huge mechanical jaws filled with razor teeth. They looked oiled. They looked like they worked. The attention of the three and the rest of the assemblage was focused on a table, an altar. The equipment arranged around it was state-of-the-art, hospital-grade, and strapped to the table, it was Rosalie. Her sweetened coffee hair was a mass at the head of the altar. No straps held her in place. She lay still, dead still. One of the red robes stood over her, using delicate, menacing instruments from a metal tray to dissect her hand. As he shaved the web of skin between her thumb and forefinger, Pax heard it, staccato breaths that might as well have been thunder in the acoustical chamber. And that was Pax, thunderstruck. His muscles locked, his blood turned solid and frozen needles pushed through it. They'd immobilized her body and paralyzed her vocal cords, but she was still alive, and she was conscious. The monk was harvesting her organs, butchering her meat, and she was awake for all of it. Pax didn't stop to identify himself. He racked the ethicon and put a full spread in the red rope's chest. The hooded figure jolted back, knocking over some kind of freestanding monitor that resembled an alien robot. In his horror, Pax short-stroked the ethicon and the spent shell jammed, mashed flat and sticking halfway out of the chamber like a little plastic tongue. A sudden, insane panic filled Pax. Surrounded by these stoic red devils, the muzzle blast still ringing in his ears, amplified by the chamber and the sheer, eerie stillness. But mostly it was Rosalie splayed open on the mortician's altar that had his brain and blood acid fizzing. He dropped the shotgun and yanked his HK out of its holster. It was an entry nightmare, needing to cover 3 dozen people at once. Impossible. Only no one seemed to notice. No one stirred or even raised their hoods. "Police!" Pax yelled. In the chamber, his voice was a chorus. "Nobody's moving! Are we clear?" He hustled up to the altar. Pax reached down and brushed the hair from Rosalie's face. Instead of moving a few strands, his hand came away with all of it. He found himself holding a wig, looking down at a bristly crew cut dyed platinum. Not Rosalie. He'd been seeing both what he wanted and what he didn't want in that hair. What was under it was probably a hooker. Clear European ancestry in her face, in the big eyes that stared blankly up at him, in another reality of pain where Pax didn't exist. She was an import. A Dutch import, he'd guess. A footstep on stone drew his attention in the muzzle of the HK. One of the red robes was descending the collection of marble boulders. The last step put no more than 4 yards between them. When she pulled back the hood and that carafe-poured hair came tumbling down, there was no surprise left in Pax. He didn't lower his gun. His fist only tightened around its grip, fingertip testing the counter-pressure of the trigger. Rosalie looked down at the cutter Pax had dropped. "Poor Kaspari," she lamented. "And Emil, who you surprised in the corridor. That shotgun was a poor choice, John. You've torn up good meat." "I'm not going to be eating them," he said, keeping her locked in his sights. "Then you're a murderer. How's that? Leaving precious meat to rot is forbidden here. Killing for the sake of killing is murder. What about fratricide? You murdered your brother." "I saved him, the only way I could. I wanted Donnie to be part of this, so I made him part of me." "When you tried to bring him in, he threatened to blow the lid off this place, didn't he?" "Let's not waste time with a meaningless review, Detective." "Meaningless? Why do you think I'm here?" "Because you're ready. You arrived here on your own. I'm learning that's the most important thing. Donnie wasn't ready. I loved him, but trying to force him down here was a mistake." "I'm not your brother. And this ends tonight." Rosalie smiled and shook her head. She was the mother and Pax a naive child. "You think you could put an end to flesh, John? You can't change an animal's nature by killing it. To erase that, you have to hunt the animal to extinction. Are you prepared to do that, John? And if you are, if you kill all of us, not just here in this room, but every person everywhere who craves the flesh, then what's the point? The only one left will be you. You see how useless this is?" "It's my job. You're a killer. I'm a police officer. That's all it is. You go ahead and make it about whatever you want. It ends the same way. You really should join us, John. There's hunger in you. I've seen it. Hunger and so much ability. We value both here more highly than you can imagine. You'd never want for anything again. Food, respect, the advancement you've earned 12 times over. You can have me. I know you want me. You can have me in every way I can give myself to you. I'm waiting for the 'and all you have to do is' part." "All you have to do, John, is let go." Rosalie tilted her delicate chin back, looking briefly at the ceiling of the chamber, beyond it. Let go of everything up there. You think you're saving a dying world, but all you're doing every day is picking at a corpse, rancid and decaying. You can feast like a lion or like a maggot, John. It's your choice. Rosalie Barillo, you're under arrest for the murder of Donald Barillo. You're coming with me. Promise me something, John. Get down on your knees and place your hands above your head. Promise you'll taste of me. It's the only other way out of here for you. We've made a covenant in this place. You eat what you kill. Simple, beautiful animal. We obey only the covenant. Everything else is meaningless. We're free. You're coming with me, Rose, Pack said again. Only inside of you, she said, stepping down from the dais and moving toward him. Her expression betrayed nothing. Only as part of you. His knuckles were white over the .45's combat grips. Stop right there, Rose. There's no going back. We only move forward. God damn it, Rose, stop! Pack screamed, the echo sounding more like a tortured plea with each reflection. He could hear the attendants push the heavy chamber doors together until they slammed home. Red robes surrounded him, a crimson tidal wave rising to engulf his entire world. And still Rosalie advanced. It's the only other way out for you. Although Pax knew the blood wouldn't show against her robes, although he knew it would be over in a nanosecond, he still closed his eyes before pulling the trigger. Deep into the after hours, they sat in the captain's office drinking Bass Armagnac from brown paper cups. The bottle came out of his bottom drawer. Who knew old Steelhead got a stagger on from effeminate European liqueurs? So how do we file this one, Pax? Steelhead asked, pouring them both another. Pax stared into his cup like a man looking for answers in tea leaves. Finally, he said, Svitter sold the sacrificial. He might as well have sold Donald Barillo to the two crazy cannibal fucks he's dead with. Move the heat onto him. He's past feeling it. All the papers need are a couple of names. They'll let it go at that.
What about the girl?
Not our problem.
How do you figure that?
Down in that cellar, I never saw faces. Pax stopped. He needed another drink. It was expensive booze, but it looked bitter on his face. He went on, other than hers. But my guess is that the juice in that feasting chamber could grease an Iraqi into the White House. They'll figure out something. Steelhead nodded. He seemed to accept that without too much trouble. Then he asked,
What about the Dutchman?
You gotta know your limits, boss. The Dutchman, whoever takes that on will never read about it in the papers. Either because it never happens or because that guy'll have to be so far outside the lines you couldn't map him. I'm just a civil servant. I got a W-2, I got life insurance equity. I'm a number. I don't unmask the Black Phantom. My gig was a perp. Just a perp. And I got her. Now I'm clocking out and going home. They fell silent for a while. It might have stayed that way, but Steelhead had to know. How in unholy Malbolge's eighth circle of hell did you get out of there, man? I mean, even you. All the fucked up places you walked out of. You were at the center of the earth surrounded by Morlocks. I think you're mixing up Jules Verne's and H.G. Wells there, boss. Come on, Pax. How are you here to tell me about all of it? They got rules, Pax said, and then, tipping his paper cup until all that was left inside was its stained brown bottom. I followed the rules. Steelhead didn't ask any more. He understood.
Thank you for listening to The End of Flesh, Part 4, by Matt Wallace. We hope all of you have a safe and wonderful holiday season. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like Variant Frequencies, please tell your friends about us. Thank you. from the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Anne Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
Consider this promo a controlled substance. Only one drug can bring the visceral and the sublime together in a single trip, where the best and the worst of the human drive boils down into a techno-art concoction that's half street-level heaven and half the fiery beauty of hell. From Matt Wallace, Parsec award-winning author of The Failed Cities Monologues, this is The Next Fix. Kick back to the strains of Earth's Last Top 40 as the final human DJ sends a shout-out over the last frequency. Step into the hard-boiled beauty of the Lusting Corridor, where that which once escaped a man is met again. Tool up with a lone cop who polices the terrifying carrion underground of the future as you seek the end of flesh. Experience one of the most unique and captivating imaginations in fiction today, collected for the first time anywhere in print and featuring 12 original stories and one full-length novella, The Next Fix by Matt Wallace.
Hi, this is Mer Lafferty from I Should Be Writing and Playing for Keeps and a bunch of other stuff. But I just wanted to say that Matt Wallace is big like Bear. He is smart like Bear. And he writes like Bear. Scary stories that roar at you and make you look for the closest tree to climb. Maybe if you roll over and play dead, the next fix won't bite. Maybe.
Matt Wallace serves up two-fisted literary action, if, of course, your fists are half-cybernetic, the size of ham hocks, and covered in broken glass.
Hey, everybody. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son podcast novel trilogy here. Matt Wallace is the boogeyman in your closet. He's the monster under your bed. He's the shadow that slides along the walls. Matt Wallace's writing is so compelling and so terrifying that you'll keep turning the pages, addicted to his work, questing for the next fix.
You order your copy today in limited edition hardcover from ApexBookCompany.com. Are you ready for the next fix?
Something new from PodioBooks.com.
In a future where noir, cyberpunk, and visceral horror make mind-bending bedfellows, the only thing that separates a forsaken urban sprawl from a half-finished technological utopia is 16 miles of river. They're known as the Failed Cities. Two worlds populated by shadow agents, street soldiers, reluctant detectives, and femme fatales. When a single conspiracy touches them all, the story can only be told in their voices. Ethan, the street preacher. Truck, the hot-rodding neo-hipster, Knifesmith. The feral twins, whose passion for death and each other is the only escape from their own tormented psyches. Just a few of the characters that drive one of the most unique storytelling experiences in fiction today. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son trilogy, calls the Failed Cities monologues gritty, imaginative, believable. T. Morris, author of Moravi, says the Failed Cities monologues creates a chilling tapestry of inner darkness that finds its outside voice. It's not a matter of wanting to listen. You have to. Visit PodioBooks.com to hear the series that's redefining the rules of podcast fiction. Variant Frequencies presents The Failed Cities Monologues by Matt Wallace. 8 lives, 2 cities, 1 story.
Get this book and more free titles from PodioBooks.com.